Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
Patrick, you look kind of pale. Are you going to be able to do the show today?
Well, I'm kind of nervous, Jim. We usually don't talk about controversial topics on our podcast.
No, Patrick, it's spelled with a U, not an O.
Oh.
Okay, Patrick, it is, as we're recording this, Sunday morning. Not necessarily Sunday morning coming down for me today, but it's Sunday morning nevertheless. And we are going to do a patron episode, one of the episodes where we have on a supporter of the show and he gets to pick the topic. And yep. For him, it's like late in the day.
Yeah.
On this same day. So that's because we have on... listener Stephen Routledge from Scotland. Hello, Stephen.
Hi, Jim and Patrick. Good to speak to you. It's not that late. It's only 4 in the afternoon, so it's not too bad.
Okay.
It's quite civilized.
Yes, you're having some tea.
I am indeed. So,
yeah. Cheers. Now, so let me ask you about that. Well, let's introduce ourselves. So I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
The show is called Rockin' the Suburbs, and we are worldwide.
That's right.
Right. Okay. So let's talk about tea for a second here, because I think it's different for the Brits than it is, you know, for the Americans, right? Like, tea here is like sort of like the alternative to coffee. Maybe if you're not a coffee drinker, you drink tea. It's usually still mostly like, I would say, a morning beverage, would you say, Patrick?
Yeah, or if you have a cold, you know,
yes,
you'll get
cold,
some tea, right?
Yes, you have a cold, like that. Have some tea with lemon. Absolutely. But what is it? Do you drink, how often do you drink tea in Scotland?
Well, I know coffee is much more popular in the UK than it used to be, and I have read some horrendous thing that apparently had overtaken from tea. But I don't drink coffee at all, because I don't like coffee. So I drink tea. Yeah, if I have a hot drink, it's none of tea. So I take tea with breakfast. You know, a cup of tea if I'm at work, a customer makes me a cup of tea. I'll have a cup of tea after my dinner, or if I'm having sitting watching someone in the evening with my wife. You know, so. I've never been to the States yet, but I will travel prepared, because I know when I go to Europe, I have to take my own tea bags with me, because trying to get a decent cup of tea in Europe is hard.
That's interesting.
I normally just ask for hot, particularly for breakfast. You need a good cup of tea at breakfast. And so normally I just take my tea bag and just ask for boiling water and can add milk to it. And I'm
some milk,
to go.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But, all right.
There you go.
Tea talk.
That's it.
Yes. One last thing before we get started on the topic here as well. You know, speaking of American things, I know Stephen, well, you know, before we started recording, we were talking a little bit about the football, as in soccer.
Uh-huh.
But Stephen has also become a bit of an American football fan. And in fact, we share the same team. And I'm going to show on the camera here that I have on my my Browns t-shirt
Browns t-shirt.
Go Browns. Go
absolutely. Go Browns. Most definitely.
When you come to the States, you'll have to go to the visit the dog pound.
Yeah, well, I have seen them live. I did go and see them when they played over at Twickenham. So yeah, I went down to London for that game. So,
and what was that experience like?
Fantastic. I even know we were winning at half time, although we did that was the 2016 season. So, so I thoroughly enjoyed it. I don't think the stadium experience outside the stadium is anything like what it would be at American Stadium, from what I've seen on YouTube and stuff like that. It was quite tame, really, by comparison, and very controlled, which a lot of what I've seen, sometimes it isn't that controlled in the car park.
Right.
Outside the stadium, in the parking lots, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, no, it's a drunken party.
Very organized. But galingly, they would have been coming over to play the Jags this year had the London games gone ahead, so I could have gone to see them again this year. But obviously they've all been, well, who knows if they'll even get to any games yet at this rate.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
Who knows? So, well, we welcome you.
That's good, good to be here.
As a Browns backer.
Yeah, there you go.
That's what we're called. Okay. All right, so I mentioned this is a patron episode, so we do these from time to time, and we have certain listeners who support the show on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/suburbspod, and many of those listeners get to pick a topic every so often. This is Steven's first time on the show in that regard. He's normally on sending his monthly dispatches of new music, one of which you will have just heard
That's
on the podcast. But But this is first time, like, truly, like, interacting with us, Patrick. It's very exciting. And so, Stephen, what did you want to talk about?
I wanted to talk about one of my favorite bands. They're certainly in my top 10 favorite bands of all time. And they burned very brightly, but briefly. And that's a band called Manson. And they were sort of in the Britpop era is when they came along. Mm-hmm. But they don't really sound very much like the bands around them at the time, which is part of, I guess, what we'll hopefully talk about. And I just really, their first two albums are absolute classics. And I've got everything they've ever done. I've got all the singles, all the alternate versions. I've got the whole lot, everything. Now, admittedly, they only put out three studio albums. There was then an album that's cobbled together from the sort of aborted fourth album sessions before mm-hmm. they split up.
And a lot of EPs too.
Yeah. It's kind of how I discovered them was back in that, I'm not sure you remember back in the sort of 90s, a lot of bands would put out two CD singles. So yep. you'd buy it twice because if you were into the band, to get the extra B-sides.
Yep.
And bands that I was into in that sort of time, I would definitely do that, buy both versions. And from their fourth EP onwards, they did the first three, I think, were just single versions. And then the fourth one onwards, they did the double throughout. And I bought one of their singles and just loved not just the main track, but what was on the B-sides as well. And that's what really thought, I need to get stuck into this band immediately.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So just for the record, for people who are not familiar, the band is Manson. That's Mansun. And it's not to be confused with Marilyn Manson.
Yes, correct.
So that's most a whole different thing.
Most definitely not like that. And unfortunately, there was a sort of a bit of a time period crossover there. And occasionally people would think you were into sort of black eyeliner and leather trousers and stuff if you like this band, but not quite the same aesthetic generally.
So should we hear something from the band? What would you like to play?
I'd start off with probably what is their most well-known song, and that's the one that I discovered through, which is Wide Open Space.
There you go. That's from their debut album, Attack of the Grey Lantern, 1997.
Were either of you familiar with that song?
Yeah, I was going to say, I knew the band and I knew a couple of their songs. I went back through my sort of digital archive, essentially, which is a lot of CDs I burned with MP3 files on them. Mm-hmm. If you guys remember around the time of 2000, you know, in those couple of years, there were things like Napster and LimeWire and things like that. And I went back and found a Manson file that contained the first three albums. So I had downloaded that at one point. And I can't remember spending a tremendous amount of time with it, but definitely remembered that song. And I did a kind of a crash course this morning in going back and listening to it. So, yeah, I would say familiar in kind of a cursory way.
The debut album debuted at number one. It knocked Blur's eponymous album, the one with song two on it, off the top of the charts. So it did land with quite a big splash. And they are very kind of English band. They don't sound anything like the Kinks or Bowie or the Beatles or Pink Floyd, but they've got there's a thread there of similarity, yeah, of sort of sensibility that perhaps I mean that was their biggest hit probably and most well known song. It's a song about agoraphobia, which isn't really the normal sort of pop music fare as a rule, and certainly wasn't the normal Britpop fare at the time, you know, when you got everyone just basically trying to be the next Noel Gallagher, you know, and churning that sort of stuff out. Although I have to just, you say you listened to those albums, Patrick, that I noticed when you pulled it up, and I was aware, I've only recently realized this, that the albums you've got, the US versions are not the original versions.
Yeah, I was learning that this morning.
What do you mean?
Yeah, like the Beatles, they chopped and changed it around. So when you put up the screen share there, Take It Easy Chicken is not on the UK version. I spent £20 to buy the CD single version of that because it was quite rare at the time when I first discovered the band. And because I'd seen them live and they closed with it because it like really rocks that particular song. And I was like, I have to get that. What is this song? I need to get it. And so both the first two albums are significantly different in the US versions to the original UK versions.
Which were put out on Epic Records. So I guess it was Epic, you know, trying to put a song they thought might be a hit in the US or something like that, Stephen. I don't know. But
yeah, I think they wanted to make it maybe more rocky. I'm not sure, less weird, because there is a weirdness there, particularly when you get to the second album. But yeah, I don't know whether the ability to stream the correct inverted commas version is there for folks over your side of the world. But
yeah, it's a great point.
Yeah, because they're significantly different track listings, and given that first album is a loose concept album, that kind of does have a bearing on things, you know.
Right, just to insert something that's maybe not related.
Yeah, I gather they did that with the original Beatles albums as well, didn't they? Your versions of them are different to our versions.
Took a while for them to come in sync. I think it was all the way up until maybe Rubber Soul, right, before they were actually released.
Not even then. I think there were still differences.
What was it even later?
I think it was Sgt. Pepper's one that was exactly the same.
So
I think,
there you go. Yeah.
Attention, particularly when this album, Attack of the Grey Lantern, came out, you know, it starts, you got to remember, this is the absolute, you know, obviously, but I guess Britpop wasn't such a big deal over stateside, but here it just dominated everything.
Yeah,
and yeah, you had your big three of Oasis, Blur, and Pulp, and you had like Suede, who were like the John the Baptists in the desert beforehand, a few years earlier, who sort of set the path. And then you just had like this explosion of wannabe Oasises and bands like that. Some of the stuff was, you know, as with any kind of scene that develops, bands that are then try and replicate that, you know, there was quite a lot of rubbish. But Manson were originally signed because they were going to be a bit like Oasis, and you know, in the early singles and a couple, and certainly on this album, probably Egg Shaped Fred is the only song you can really hear that come through, where it's got that kind of Paul Draper, who's the front man and songwriter, he's still got that Liam Gallagher-esque kind of sneer to his voice, which disappears quite quickly because they were signed before they'd ever played live, before they even had a drummer.
Yeah.
They were signed on the basis of his songwriting. They got a songwriting pub deal, then they got signed to Parlophone, EMI, and then, so there was kind of a little bit of this is an industry-created band backlash around them initially to start with. But I've seen them live. I saw them live a few times, and yeah, they were fantastic. But there was certainly a record label buzz around them at the time, which kind of, I think, maybe had a negative impact on them. But it's just the whole album, it opens with these like John Barry-esque strings and closes with them as well. And it's like, okay, this is not Roll With It or Cigarettes and Alcohol.
We'll be right back.
yeah, the ambition was there from the very first opening notes of the album to the very last notes. There were so many ideas going on in this album, and then they just took that and flew with that with the next album. But it just stood out like a sore thumb. It's like, yeah, this is not what everyone else is doing, and part of that was, I guess, why I was so drawn to it and why I just followed them avidly for the sort of short period that they were active.
Yeah, I mean, I hear what you're saying, because I was not familiar with this band really at all until you brought it to my attention. I've been listening a bit in preparation for this episode, but I would not have immediately categorized this as Britpop to my way of thinking of that sort of subgenre. To me, that this is like, how do I describe it? It feels more orchestrated in some way, or sort of denser, I think, than a lot of the stuff I think of as Britpop. I don't know. It's hard for me to categorize. The band I kind of thought of right away from that same sort of era was Garbage. That's who I kind of thought they sounded kind of like.
Interesting.
Am I wrong on that?
I personally wouldn't say they sound, but I can see where you're coming from. I definitely, yeah, if you're sort of searching for a sort of a contemporary reference point, uh-huh. I guess, but, and certainly dense is a good word to describe the music, because there is, you know, if you want to really dive into it, there's an awful lot there to get stuck into, you know, but you have got some good tunes that you can just have on in the background just to hum along to as well. It's not really art rock, because that makes you think of someone else.
Right,
but it's kind of arty rock.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's got pop, stroke rock, stroke alternative, stroke indie, whatever you want to call it. It's very much an arty style to it, and an artistic kind of direction that encompasses the whole thing, rather than it just being, here's some songs that I wrote.
And they were a band that played a lot, right? Steven, from what I was reading, like they toured a lot in the early part of the band.
Yeah, they had to, because they basically, when they came together, Dominic Chad, who was the lead guitar player, and so does a lot of those sort of very keening sort of guitar lines that are quite distinctive. He could play, and he'd been in other bands. And then Andy Rathbone, they got the drummer, he joined the band, and he could play as well. But particularly the bass player and Paul Drakewell, they weren't great musicians to start with, and they kind of had to play a lot to learn how to play, you know. And which is, again, part of why they had a little bit of kickback against them from sort of the cool, NME, Millennium Maker, to start with, kind of, there was this kind of like, okay, sort of crossed arms, show us what you can do sort of attitude. And they had to gig a lot, but they got... When I saw them two or three times, I think I saw them, and they rocked really hard, and they certainly had a sort of punk attitude to them, which isn't really in the music, but you certainly got that live, and you maybe get more of that again in the second album. But the other kind of way I was thinking of describing them, saying about the arty rock, but it's kind of like prog punk, because they got progressive elements to them. And certainly, again, in the second album, Six, there's a lot of cut-up time changes and multi-parts to the song, long songs and all this stuff. But they've also got this kind of punk rock kind of thing going on as well, with the chugging guitars at times and short, snappy melodies and stuff like that. Yeah, they say they're not that well-known, because they were very much at sort of 97 to 2000 and then they're done,
to me, they seemed like a vinyl band in a time when there was really no vinyl, right? Because, like, in the late 90s, they weren't making a, I mean, everything was coming out on CD, right? It was really looked like the death of vinyl and MP3s and everything. But they feel like one of those bands where, you know, you would have side one and side two, and you'd be sitting there reading the lyrics and staring at the cover of the record while you listen to it.
Yeah, I mean, certainly six, you know, I've got the special edition on that one as well, because, you know, yeah. I'm a sucker for all that stuff. But and yeah, having this on that sort of vinyl sized cover, you can really, this is where they really go full in on the progressive kind of, and the sort of denseness here. This is like some kind of Yes album cover, you know.
It's
just so much detail in it. And the album is kind of like that as well. I mean, it's got a spoken word interlude by Tom Baker, who was like a Doctor Who actor, famous for playing Doctor Who, kind of like between the sides, you know, even though it didn't really come out on vinyl initially, but they wanted to split it between the sides, and you've got this spoken word kind of really weird piece in between. And then you've got these four longer songs to finish, you know, for the second half of the album. And again, this was completely chopped and changed around for the US release compared to the UK release.
I'm noticing that just based on how you're describing the album, it's different. The track listing is different here. Yeah.
Very different.
Yeah, yeah. I'm guessing maybe Witness to a Murder that may not have even made it to the US version. I don't know, but that's the piece I'm talking about. I'm not suggesting you play that, because that'll probably put everyone off this band forever.
No, it wasn't on the American release.
Oh, well, all right, okay.
I'm showing you on the screen now.
Yeah, I'm seeing that. Yeah, let me. Yeah, you did. So, yeah, Witness to a Murder is not on there at all.
And obviously the first track is chopped down a lot. It's the Arthur Baker version. Yeah, the remix. Yeah.
And I think even the title track, the last track, is possibly a lot shorter as well. Let me just... Yeah, so... oh, no, it's about the same length, actually. But, so you got 13 tracks on there, and... switched it around a lot. Like Legacy is later in the album, so you got Inverse Midas is not there, it's a 13 track album on the original, and it was a much different running order, which again for six really does kind of kill it, because it is very much a piece of an it's very much an album. The songs are still good, but they're even more complex, and you take it out of context and just chop and change it like that. I'm not surprised they maybe didn't make much of a splash, because they didn't actually get a fair crack of the whip, I would say, based on what was presented to you. You know, that's record companies for you, I guess.
There was a feeling in the CD era to try to front load the discs with what you think are going to be more the popular tracks, the hit songs, because people may not actually get to the end of the disc. Because it's not broken into two sides the way albums and cassettes were, you know, records and cassettes were. So that maybe that played into it. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm guessing that's why they pulled, because Negative was singles. Legacy was a single as well. So I'm guessing they pulled Legacy right forward from being the penultimate track. And that's probably the most radio friendly of the songs on this album, I would say, is Legacy. It's kind of got more of a classic rock kind of feel to it. But
And sort of like, they're probably like, you know, if people go and put this, if this album is in like the listening station in the record store, right? We want to, they're going to listen to the first, you know, skip ahead the first 2-3 songs and make their purchase decision, right? So we want to hook them away.
What you don't want is to hit play and then get Witness to a Murder, which again, I would encourage the listeners to just seek it out, and you'll be like, what is this? It's interesting, because Paul Draper, he said, certainly his biggest musical influence was Prince, and I don't hear any Prince really in any of their music at all.
Yeah.
He certainly cites him as his biggest musical influence. Mm. And I guess maybe there's that magpie-like flitting around kind of nature, perhaps, is there, of the constantly jumping between one thing and another, rather than being like, I'm just going to do this. This is what I do. This is my style, and this is what you're going to get. Yeah, because obviously Prince did everything. And, you know... but also another band I think they covered some of their songs on some of their B-sides is Magazine.
Ah, totally. Wow.
And you maybe hear that in some of these songs on six. Certainly you would get
definitely.
That.
Definitely.
There's a lot, like I said, there's a lot going on. And certainly the second album is very dense, and I would not suggest that anyone started with that. You know, give the first album a spin. If you don't like it, you're probably not going to like the second album. But but if you do like it, you're really going to love the second album.
Okay,
you know, because it's just everything more. I mean, one song in the second album has more ideas than a lot of entire albums have. But they weren't a prog band. You know, this is not sort of 70s Genesis or Yes.
Yeah.
Got here. This is there's still an energy and there's still a poppiness and melody, you know, sort of engagingness to it that, you know, is there, hence the edited down versions to try and convince people to buy it, I guess.
Yeah. That you know, prog punk label, the more you talk about it, really seems highly apt in this case. Where do you put the third album in relation to those first two, Stephen, as far as you personally? I mean, do you rank that with, you know, up there with them or slightly below?
No, significantly below.
Okay.
I mean, the third album, things were starting to go wrong by that stage, and I definitely get the feeling that EMI, so Parlophone, whoever, basically said, right, yeah, you had a number one album, so then you went crazy on your second album. Mm-hmm. Now give us some pop songs, please. And, you know, the third album, don't get me wrong, I still bought all the singles, I still like the third album.
Do you have the deluxe edition?
There's not been a deluxe edition of that.
Okay.
Tellingly, there's not been a deluxe edition of that yet. And maybe there will, maybe there won't, but I suspect possibly there won't, because it's, you know, it starts with... Yeah, the first song on the third album is called Butterfly, A New Beginning, and the last song is called Goodbye. I mean, and one of the songs is I Can Only Disappoint You, which is probably my favourite from that album, Little Kicks. But, you know, you don't even have to listen to it to know, pretty much get an idea of what's going on. there's no fancy artwork on the sleeve. It's a picture of the band in black and white. You know, there's no concept album stuff going on. It's just like, you know... And actually on that, I mean, you can see a little of the Prince influence there with...
I was going to say,
the soundtrack for Two Lovers, kind of written with the numbers, you know.
Yeah, I Can Only Disappoint You also with just the U.
Travel from Dublin.
Certainly, he didn't, hadn't forgotten how to write songs, And, you know, I can only disappoint you. Particularly Comes As No Surprise, which is a real favourite for mine off of Little Kicks, and Until the Next Life, which sort of harks back to that epic sort of widescreen sound of the first album. There's still great stuff in there, but it's clearly less. You know, it's just, you know, so, you can sometimes with stuff it can be any kind of form of art, whether it's painting, music, film, writing. Sometimes you start something and you're like, this is really good. This has a quality to it. And those first two albums have that, and the third album is like, yeah, this is okay. Ironically, probably people who don't like the first two albums will probably enjoy the third one more because it's much more straightforward. Ah,
interesting.
And it's less, you know, it still sounds like them because they've got a particular sound that comes across in their music, but you're not getting the full on like head expanding weirdness, particularly of six. You know, it's like, here's a bunch of songs, whereas the first two are, here's these pieces of work. You know, and the first album, okay, was pulled together and it's not a full sort of concept. It's kind of this very loose concept. Whereas the second album is just like, it's just on another planet. You know, it's just like, how many ideas do you want? Well, all the ideas, please.
In every song.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, we've just got, yeah, yeah, we've got all the ideas you want, and then some you probably don't, you know. So, so whilst there's still some good songs on the third album, the rot are kind of set in, yeah, and that's kind of why I guess I said at the start there, they burn brightly but briefly, you know. And that's kind of the shame of it for me, because normally with bands, it's the second album, that's the one where you know whether they've got it or not, because it's, you know, it's always the case. And like, do they take a step up, or do they just retread because they've used all their ideas? You know, and you look at, you know, so many bands over the years, but you know, someone like Radiohead, you know, they went from being, you know, a Nirvana kind of poor man's Nirvana from Oxford to the Bends. And like, okay, wow, this is, yeah, the Benz comes out compared to Pablo Honey, like, wow, this is, yeah, giant leaps forward. And then OK Computer is even more so. And yeah, you look at the leap between Attack of the Grey Lantern and the Six, again, it's massive, even though they were starting from quite a high place. They weren't starting from, you know, Three Chords and the Truth.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were starting from also orchestral, widescreen stuff.
Yeah.
And then went further, but also, you know, they made it more aggressive as well. It wasn't that they just went and did more of the same, just turned it up louder and put more and more of it on. They did something very different, but was recognisably a big step on in terms of quality and in terms of intensity and kind of any kind of measure you want, probably other than sales and success. You know? Yeah.
So then what happened to the band after three albums?
Well, yeah, they kind of then disappeared after that, because what I think what happened is there was kind of a bit of internal ructions, and I think really they wanted to try and take the things away from Paul Draper being the guy who was driving it all and writing the songs, and it kind of just imploded from there, really, because he was the principal songwriter. You're right, okay, you try and put aside the principal songwriter, and it just kind of fell apart from there, and it's sort of acronymy, really. I think, but also because of the disappointment, I think of how, you know, Six was not well loved or well received at the time, I don't think, but it's become beloved over time, because people appreciated what an absolute, so an amazing kind of ahead of its time almost. And if you put Six on, it's like it could have been recorded this year. It doesn't sound like it was recorded in 1998. The debut, somewhat, because there's still the hints of that, the era in which it arrived. But the second album is like, if that came out today, you'd be like, wow, this sounds brave.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is adventurous. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, it's not timeless because it doesn't sound classic, but it is timeless in the way that it doesn't really fit into a slot of this is the scene that it's come from. And I think it probably all goes back to when they were first signed. You know, bands were looking for, labels were looking for the next Oasis.
Mm-hmm.
They thought that's what they were maybe going to get, and they didn't get, they got something else entirely. And for those that I think they're a very beloved band, you know, in that people who love them really, really love them.
Yeah.
And everyone else just knows Wide Open Space.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
But if you love them, you probably like me, you've probably got everything. I don't think there's many casual Manson fans. Yeah, if you put on, you know, What's the Story, Morning Glory, or, Park Life, or, yeah, anything else from that era, a lot of it sounds very much of its era. Whereas, they say, this is just kind of landed from outer space, kind of.
Fascinating. And, it really is.
And so, yeah, for any listeners who like really interesting rock music, this is really interesting rock music. Certainly when I was in the mid-90s and I was in kind of my absolute sort of peak of buying music as much as possible, you always want to get in on a band at the ground floor,
yeah,
don't you? Yeah,
right.
There's so many times you find a band and then you know, to get the early stuff, it was either too expensive or there was only a certain amount of copies produced. And this was one of the bands that, okay, I got them at the fourth single, but I got them before the album came out. Yeah, and I got them where I could still get hold of the first singles.
Yeah,
some of them I had to pay a bit more to get, and then I could just write. This is one of my bands, and I had a few bands like that at the time. Yeah, Teenage Fan Club being one, and some others. And I was like, right, okay, I'm all in on this band, and I'm just going to get every single thing they put out until it stops being good, you know. And I never regretted it, you know. I just find the music endlessly enjoyable and fascinating, you know. And I thought maybe. Not many listeners, particularly stateside, will have heard of them, and maybe they might enjoy it.
Yeah, absolutely.
No, I think that's very true. So hopefully we've turned some listeners on to Manson.
This is really, really interesting. I'm primed for a Sunday of listening to Manson more myself, so I'm pretty excited about it.
What's the best setting for listening to this band?
Oh, well, other than live, of course, I guess, yeah. It's kind of not a sunny afternoon. You want it to be dark, I would suggest, at night, possibly with headphones would probably be the best.
Yeah.
Maybe with a spirit of your choice, you know, or two. Because of the sound that they create and the hugeness of that sound, that widescreen sound, I keep saying widescreen, but, you know, it's definitely, and if you just play the first album from the start, you get that because it's like, oh, hang on, this is John Barry starting up here, you know.
Yeah.
They've got that kind of, that Pink Floyd kind of, like, you listen to this on headphones in the dark kind of vibe as well, you know.
Where you can hear all the intricacies, all the little pieces, right? Yeah. You know, this would be good, Patrick, if you were, say, somebody who owned a record pressing plant and had like a $10,000
yes,
stereo,
that'd be the one.
You know,
that'd
available.
One, yeah.
This would be a good one to put on, right?
Very true. Yeah. Probably would be, yeah.
Yeah. Your little Bluetooth speaker in the shower, probably not.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. On the back deck while you're doing something else now. Yeah.
Yeah. You're not going to get the full impact of it. So, but yeah, definitely on a decent system and yeah, in the evening, I would suggest.
All right.
It's definitely better.
Cool. Well, thanks very much. This was great.
This is great. Yeah.
Thank you.
I think it's a perfect choice. And, it just goes to show, I know we dedicate, what, 5 or 6 episodes to new music these days, but great case in point that there's a lot of stuff that can be brand new to you that happened, you know, 20 years ago or something like that, if you're looking in the right places. And this seems like one of those really cool discoveries, you know, to go back and just kind of learn about this and with the, I guess, I always, you know, think it was so interesting that Steve was talking about, you know, the sort of kickback there was, or, you know, the arms folded, show us what you can do attitude toward the band in the beginning. Because when you go at it 20 years later, that lens of kind of, you know, headlines or press or whatever is wiped away, and you can look at it kind of fresh. And that,
yeah,
that's
no
that's,
one remembers that. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You've forgotten all those petty arguments or whatever it was, grudges. And now you have a fresh look at it. So that's kind of a blessing to discover something, you know, from another time and be able to go back and have it all there and make your own assessment of it.
1997, I always kind of think it's kind of like sort of my prime meridian for music. So many of the albums that I really absolutely love came out that year or very close to it, and so much like other years that other patrons have mentioned, maybe 97 is one to return to in the future. I don't know.
Interesting. Yeah,
that would be good, because I got to tell you, this the late 90s early 2000s decade were a bit of a dead period for me. I was, for whatever reason, not as actively engaged in music in that. So anytime we want to sort of look back at that era and you know, point out some of the cool stuff, I'd be all for that.
Yeah, totally. I mean, just looking really quickly, there's amazing albums in 97.
And there are indeed.
Yeah, all these records
there are
came.
Indeed.
Yeah, wow.
Well, I think as you guys say that, it's definitely in my wheelhouse.
Yeah, okay, that's right. Okay, sounds good. All right, well, we'll have you on again, Stephen. This is great.
No,
and by the way,
Stephen
is a patron who gets some records from us. We go record shopping. I just did the shopping. And so there'll be some stuff on the way. I just did the shopping yesterday. All right. Thanks again, Stephen Routledge.
Thank you, Stephen.
Again, if anyone else would like to support the show, go to patreon.com/suburbspod. And if anyone would like to talk about Manson, you can call and leave a message,
612-440-1984.
There you go. Or email rock@suburbspod.com. Or find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all those at suburbspod. All right. Let's get out of here. What would be a good play out song?
Let's play out with Take It Easy Chicken, because that rocks hard and it's good.
Okay.
They finished their live sets with that and it was good. So yeah, finish that.
What a great title too. So there we go. All right. Thanks very much. It's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And with us has been
Stephen Routledge.
All right. Cheers, mate. We'll talk to you guys later.
I've got everything they've ever done. I've got all the singles, all the alternate versions. I've got the whole lot, everything.